I don't think that the SRE job is going to disappear whatsoever. I just think it will become much more about tool building and enabling. And then the top of the pyramid will be things like, okay, so let's analyze the human, let's analyze the sociotechnical system that we've got.
Yeah.
What tools are missing so that as an entire sociotechnical system, we are actually getting better and better and better at reliability over time.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we improve production by challenging the status quo. Your host, Armin Astani from Chirto Modo.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check.
Reliability Rebels.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we explore how to make software and systems more reliable by challenging the status quo. I'm your host, Amin Astani. Software engineering teams just unlocked a powerful and dangerous capability. They can now generate code faster than they can safely ship it. Over the past 6 months, AI-assisted development has enabled teams to produce much more code than before, but everything else, CI/CD pipelines, code review capacity, operational readiness, incident response, stayed the same, leading to significant delivery challenges downstream. This here is the AI code tsunami. It's not theoretical. High-performing teams with experienced leaders are already beginning to feel the strain. Today's guest is fighting this problem from both sides. Kyle Forster is CEO of RunWen, winner of Gartner's Cool Vendors and AI SRE, also former senior director of Kubernetes at Google. He's currently building AI-enabled tooling to help teams make better operational and business decisions in increasingly complex Kubernetes-based production environments without the giant data retention bill typically found in observability vendors. But his own engineering team, they're navigating the same velocity crisis his customers encounter. No easy answers, no playbook. Welcome to the frontier. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I mean, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Definitely a pleasure. So let's get right into it, starting with a little bit about yourself. You've been in engineering and product leadership at some pretty interesting places.
I can happily to talk about myself all day long, but I also had a question for you. Last time we spoke, you were just crossing New Mexico. Man, how was the cross-country trip?
Oh my goodness, I'm being interviewed. I love this. So I just finished a drive from Las Vegas area. It went pretty well, though on the first day, I had some serious difficulties with my solar setup. New Mexico did in fact feature a lot of wind, and it blew one of my roof rack assemblies right out of socket and shattered one of the panels. Luckily, nothing else bad happened, and the rest of the trip was uneventful. But it's like every time I drive through Mexico, something bad happens.
That for me is Nevada. Every time I drive through Nevada, something bad happens. I kept seeing your pictures and thinking, God, in between my time at Google and right as I was getting RunWen started and this fantastic road trip from we're living in San Francisco at the time with my wife and kids up to see her parents in Calgary. And I kept seeing your pictures and just kept thinking, God, I love that time. Love that time. I was so jealous of what you were doing last week.
Oh, well, thank you. It was the first time I've driven cross country numerous times as part of my nomadic lifestyle, but it's the first time I've crossed it towing something. And that is a completely different experience. Like your level of awareness and vigilance is just through the roof for 11 hours a day. It's totally different than driving a car or even a truck.
So let's call it higher risk reliability problems.
Correct. Yes.
If you're responsible for a SaaS product and you've been dealing with reliability issues, maybe you migrated to the cloud, rolled out microservices, even hired DevOps or SRE specialists, but you're still seeing incidents and slow delivery, you're not wrong for being frustrated. And you're not wrong for trying those things. It seems like every conference talk and blog post recommends them. Here's what host Amin Astani has learned. Reliability problems are rarely technical. They're organizational. That's why he created the Rapid Assessment. It diagnoses what's actually broken, for one flat rate. Learn more at certomodo.io. Thanks for listening.
Back to you, man. Tell us a little bit about your background.
The idea for RunWhen first came, I was on the Kubernetes team at Google. We're heavily inspired by these internal tools that were in use. And a lot of what was going on is kept thinking about, hey, back in 2019, 2020, how do you get an engineer who's never seen Kubernetes before really productive, troubleshooting Kubernetes on their first day? And you know, I just kept spending time thinking about that problem and kept thinking in the broader context, also kept thinking about, hey, there's so many AWS trained engineers. How do you get an AWS trained engineer to be really productive troubleshooting GCP on their first day? As you can imagine, for Google Cloud, this is a massive economic problem. And that thinking evolved and evolved and evolved. And I kind of concluded that, hey, what you really want is to be able to take somebody who hasn't seen their infrastructure underneath, who hasn't seen their platform underneath, who hasn't seen the open source, you know, Kafka, Postgres, Nginx, Kafka on top, and who hasn't seen the particular first-party services before, because when an incident happens, you never really know which part of the stack is going to be the root cause.
Yeah.
And can you get one person to span every single layer in the stack? That, to me, was just this really cool vision. Mm-hmm. I saw some early work inside of Google that was being done in that area. And that's really what got me inspired to leave that company and to start RunWhen.
Yeah. Wow. As a person who worked at a big tech organization, I find your vision particularly compelling, because when I was at Meta, you know, the stack is so gigantic and the tools so, you know, custom built, that the task of being able to isolate a production problem from top to bottom as like the scope of where to look is needle in haystack to me. Like I remember troubleshooting sessions being quite daunting if you didn't have the observability in place.
I mean, this is exactly the needle in the haystack problem over and over and over again. When you kind of know some parts of the haystack really well and some parts of the haystack are pretty new to you, I figured that if we could solve that problem, we were solving a big engineering velocity problem. Like, hey, how can you just avoid war rooms with like 20 people and 30 people and 50 people? Every once in a while, I was getting pulled into those. And it's a nightmare, right? Like you have 45 people hanging around watching three people who are very, very, very busy. But you also were watching like 20 or 30 engineering projects that are getting delayed. So there to me was a real economic problem there. There's a massive economic problem. The more people that are involved in an incident, the longer it's going to take to figure it out. Okay, so like just downtime is a huge problem. But I think the problem also rears its head in all kinds of other little ways, like in non-prod environments. If you can get developers to be able to help themselves more than the escalate and wait of, oh, I'm waiting on the platform team. Oh, I'm waiting for infrastructure help. I'm waiting on the platform team again. I'm waiting on infrastructure help. I'm waiting for a Vault expert to help me out. I'm waiting for a Kafka expert to help me out. When you can kind of break out of that culture and into, hey, I can solve any issue pretty much by myself and I can always get myself unblocked. I think it has huge economic implications, and there are also just better places to work.
For sure. For sure. I definitely relate to the three people really busy in a war room and then having 30, 40 people just kind of sitting there waiting. Not super efficient, very stressful. Yeah, definitely relate to the problem space you're trying to solve. So you demoed this for me a few weeks ago as we were getting acquainted and we were exploring the idea of you joining Reliability Rebels. When you did that, it was super clear that your approach to gathering and storing metrics and information about the system is very different than traditional observability vendors, right? In your metrics, logs, traces. So walk me through the what and the why here, and importantly as well, like what trade-offs does your strategy create?
Yeah, the timing for this recording is prescient, because there's actually this conversation back and forth right now between Charity Majors and I on LinkedIn on this topic, and it's getting, I just kind of keep on seeing the stats sort of going viral at the moment. I had posted something that really caught her eye. I think I mentioned, like, we did this study towards the end of last year of how our tools was getting used in production. And the agentic loops that were running when people were using it, only about 30% of the tool calls were actually going back to metrics, logs, and traces, what you consider to be traditional observability data.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, so people using AI tools to do incident response are only actually using observability data 30% of the time. That was crazy, right? And think about how much money we pay for these observability stacks. Observability stacks are made for humans. They're really, really not made for agentic AI. And Charity had something in her article that I really believe. She had this wonderful way of saying it. She's like, hey, so how have we been getting by all this time? Humans fill in an enormous amount of gaps. When a human's looking at a dashboard, when a human's looking at a metrics query, when a human's looking at logs, when a human's looking at an alert stream, there's an enormous amount of context that they're filling in their brains without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And AI just doesn't have that context. So you need to fill it in as part of your software development. Like, we need to fill it in for the LLM. Mm-hmm. 70% of the data that turns out that was just getting used in these agentic loops was actually stuff that background agents had found out before the incidents. We have background agents running, gathering configuration data, doing safe database calls that are calling different application APIs to make sure that they're healthy. All this work that was happening in between incidents becomes 70% of what's actually getting used during the incident.
Yeah.
And I think when you think about it that way, you're like, yeah, you know, being in an incident requires a lot of background knowledge, and that's actually what the LLM needs. Now, the 70% wasn't traditional observability data at all. It looked more like a senior engineer wandering around the system and kind of poking around, getting up to speed, kind of poking around and kind of just remembering what they had seen. That's the context. That's actually the context that got sent to the LLM. So it's a fascinating, fascinating study. And you know, there's sort of more and more attention getting drawn into that topic.
Yeah, I did see your post. I did see, you know, Charity's view and feedback on it. And I do find that to be very interesting, because in my time being on call as a senior engineer, a person who knows most about the system, like the dashboards and the metrics only tell me the what. When I need to start exploring the why, you know, I'm SSHing into things, I'm curling endpoints, I'm looking at, like, you know, database logs, slow query logs. Like, yeah, there's the stuff that you are doing that are ad hoc, that if with the proper context and knowledge of the system, you're able to zero in on the issue rather than just looking at, you know, the basic utilization saturation metrics that you would get exposed by, you know, a typical observability stack. So yeah, I think you're definitely on to something here, and it has been proven by human experience previously. So yeah, very, very interesting. And then of course, like, the implications, just to fill in the gaps a little bit, you have these agents that are scraping data from production in the moment. What is the implication on cost? Like, if we don't need to depend on our typical observability platforms, like, what are the potential cost savings?
Yeah, I mean, we rough back of the envelope, but we think that this process of having background agents that are scraping data out of production to build context, so that when in the moment, you know, in the foreground, somebody can go live. Rough back of the envelope, we think it's like about four orders of magnitude less data than traditional logs and metrics. Wow. Four orders of magnitude. I mean, it's a huge amount less, because if you think about, a lot of it looks like CLI commands. A lot of it looks like, you know, short database queries. A lot of it can be compressed very heavily into, in our particular case, we compress it down to what we call the insights database. Less for compression, and it's a lot of it's just to re-index it so that agents can rediscover this stuff very, very, very rapidly when time is of the essence. But so four orders of magnitude less data is just a lot less data to wrangle around.
Yeah. 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 This is particularly interesting to me, because when working with clients or even discussing it with friends, you know, the typical grumbling is, hey, yeah, we have these dashboards, we have these metrics, but my goodness, aren't they expensive? So I guess with your solution in place, like, what's left? What should be dashboarded in your view? what should be captured in those traditional methods still?
I mean, I think less and less. Our system supports SLIs and SLOs as first class citizen.
Oh, wow.
So certainly some of those look a bit like dashboards, but it's we use the Meta, or at least some teams of Meta approach rather than the Google approach, even though I came from Google. In our SLIs, we have this very opinionated approach to say an SLI should either be zero or one and nothing in between. That's it. And it looks more like a unit test. And what you're really doing is you're constantly unit testing production. And that's what an SLI should look like, or maybe a sys test, whatever you want to call it. It's a test. It's a test case and you happen to run it every minute. Mm-hmm. And every time it's a one, something's healthy. And every time it's a zero, something's not. And then, you know, your SLO is really simple. You just count the zeros. How many zeros are you allowed? That's your error budget. Hey, this team is allowed 400 zeros this month. This team is allowed 100 zeros this month. It gets you past all of the, I think, the math where people really snarl up some of these metrics. And most importantly, it makes it really easy for executives to like to get it.
Right. Yeah, I see where you're coming with this. So your philosophy around a service level indicator is basically creating a condition that can either pass or fail, whether it be like, hey, the percentage of time that this particular endpoint responded with this, you know, P90 percentile. What was the percentage of time where that is true and where that is false? Yeah, I mean, for one thing, error budget calculations is way simple. if you front load that, and I imagine much more easier to reason about by executives once they understand why the SLI was made the way it was.
Yeah. I'd also like to say things like, how do you roll it all for executives? You just take the average. Really easy. Like really, 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 really easy. So I do think that there's a role for dashboards in that. But I think that whole era of visual troubleshooting, I think very soon, like as in like the end of this year, we will look back on like, okay, I look at a dashboard and then I kind of visually troubleshoot what's going on. We'll look back on that as like, that's a lot of human middleware. We can do better as an industry than treat humans like middleware.
Yeah, that I can definitely understand. I remember days of having to visually inspect a whole litany of dashboards, and all I'm really doing is using my eyeballs to detect aberrations, and then that, you know, will then lead to an inquiry about that whatever component that my eyeball goes attracted to. It would be nice to not have to do that. So I definitely agree with your sentiment for sure. Okay, so we understand the problem you're trying to solve and the philosophy behind it, and a departure from the classic observability model that we've been carrying forward for decades. But let's talk about the other side of the equation here, which is, you know, your company's software development experience in the age of, you know, AI driven development now. So you've gone all in. You and I have had some conversations in the past on how you've gone all in. So share with us how that's been going, including a specific pull request that's been in limbo for a while. Is it still in limbo? It certainly has been giving you a lot of pause.
We just actually promoted it up to the staging environment literally 3 hours ago in preparation for a push to prod tomorrow. Oh, which is a huge thing for us. Yeah, so for background, just for everybody listening, I mean, now we're talking about, we've always been very AI forward in our development. And we could see sort of the number of PRs per week steadily, very, 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 very steadily creeping up. The number of code change creeping up. The amount of story points, you know, the product manager facing story points have been creeping up. So we're getting not only heavier rates of code change, but in any measure, we're just getting more impact per person per month. And it's been a really, really steady increase with some big step functions up, I think, as a lot of people saw with some of the newer models November of last year, and then again in January. But we had this one moment where one of our two really senior tech leads, all of a sudden, something like a big light bulb went on. And it just happened 6 weeks ago. He went from getting some uplift from AI coding. And admittedly, he's working in a very, like an older part of the code base that is really complicated with a ton of dependencies and some really old code that I wrote in the very first days of our company. the light bulb just turned on, and all of a sudden, he did a few PRs, and then he did a full refactor of 2.5 years worth of code that we had written in the early days of the company, most of it mine. The result was a single PR that's a massive refactor with 285 files. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of lines of code, which usually you'd say like, oh, wow, that's a really tough thing to do. Thing for the rest of us to swallow.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you dig just a tiny bit, it's about a 15x performance increase, which is massive. Any one of us trying this in the test environment, just the user latency was just a thing of beauty. It's so much faster. Wow. We're also really sensitive on cloud costs, and this takes a massive whack at most of the core code paths that we have that are costing most of our cloud costs.
Yeah.
So we're looking at somewhere between like $6,000 and $10,000 per month that we'll save as soon as we can get this thing out into production. And yeah. So 15x faster, massive cloud costs. The other thing that he's very thoughtful about test strategy. So it has 10x the test coverage that the old code has. So our ability to move faster and faster and faster once this PR is in place is, I mean, it's not even subject to debate. Now, the trouble is a huge amount of this code is mine. And I'm the CEO of the company. So for me to review what's, I think, 285 files, something like that, like for me to do the code review, that's going to take at least a month. So we're taking the CEO of the company out for a month. If we give this to our other tech lead, like, hey, he's going to have to get up to speed on all this old stuff that I wrote. This is not a part of the system that he spends that much time on. So and then like, he's probably out for a month.
Yeah.
We're kind of coming to grips with the fact that this PR is so massive that the old approach of human review, even after many, many, many stages of AI review, this is like the PR that broke our engineering process. But it's so valuable that it's actually worth it for us to redesign our engineering process around it. And we've been using AI for a long time. This is the first time that I think it really came to a point where this is, you know, I will say it again, so valuable. It was worth us rethinking our engineering process around this one PR.
Yeah, I mean, this is the LLM has given you an offer that you can't refuse, which is better performance, order of magnitude better performance at an order of magnitude less cost. How can you not at least take a look and consider? So that all makes sense. Why you would be struggling with the decision for a while? So like what? What are the implications? So let's imagine, okay, the system is creating these changes that are hard for humans to reason about. So the classic model of code review just shatters in the face of it. What do we do instead in order to protect, you know, the system, to build organizational knowledge about what you're building, you know, all of the operational responsibilities that must be maintained? How do we keep up that standard without being able to review in the way we once did?
So I'll tell you a couple of the big design considerations we had around our engineering process, and then a couple of the outcomes. One big design consideration was, hey, this one PR can't hold up the rest of the team because the rest of the team is also moving faster and faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
So we can't suddenly like lock out major test environments just to test this. And by the way, if we spend too much time dawdling over this PR, then all of a sudden we're going to get either massive stale or we're going to have to do a lot of refactoring of other PRs on top. So we need to move through this very, 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 very quickly. Mm-hmm. So we suddenly had to, all right, we need to design an engineering process that gets us reliability. We're in the reliability business. We can't sacrifice reliability. I'm telling you, man, that's a bad look. Yeah, but we have to also within that as our header, we need to figure out how to prioritize for speed of digesting these things. What we came up with was we need to treat our test environment like prod, period, full stop. And we've seen this now at especially financial institutions that have services that do run at 5.9s reliability. Everybody uses the word 5.9s. They actually have proven some 5.9s reliability services. How are they getting there? They get there by treating dev environments and test environments just like prod. So we said, all right, we're going to start treating our test environment like prod, which means an issue in test is effectively an incident. Doesn't always need to be a 7.1 incident, but the difference between an issue and an incident for us is now like they're kind of one and the same. That means that when there's bugs in test, they're holding up other PRs. We got to get those bugs absolutely handled very, very, very fast, because otherwise they're effectively standing in the way of the freight train. So that means that there's no longer a differentiation for us between test, staging, and prod when it comes to an incident showing up. So we have a lot of incidents in our lower environments that now suddenly need to get handled.
Yeah.
The second implication was that we now need to shift, like massively shift left. And I don't even know if shift left is the right word anymore. It's shift left, shift up, shift down. We're shifting all over the place. Because yeah. A very, very, very important thing is anybody on the team in any one of our environments needs to be able to take whatever issue is blocking them. And if they can't get it all the way to resolution, they absolutely need to get it all the way to root cause so that the resolution is incredibly fast afterwards. And that was a really core design principle. Okay, so we need to get every engineer on any team to be able to handle any issue in any environment, anywhere in the tech stack. And that became the North Star. And I mean, I think that we got a little bit lucky. Like, our product supports that really, really, really well. That's very close to the North Star around which we started the company.
Yes.
But it kind of became this like, we're sitting on our own solution. As we actually found, our product found 48 issues with this PR, all of which Claude never really saw looking at source code. And Claude never really saw looking at single player dev environments, all of which were like race conditions or subtle bugs that some of these pulled up in other services that were totally outside the scope of these particular changes, but exposed bugs that have been latent sitting there for a while.
Yeah.
It exposed some bugs on API structures that had been called, and as soon as this upgraded to the new ones, other services had problems.
Yeah.
It exposed some cyclic dependencies that at the lower speeds didn't matter that much, but at the much, much higher speeds suddenly really, really showed up. But none of which you'd find by looking at the code base. Like, absolutely none of which you'd find by looking at the code base. You have to look at the runtime characteristics in a near production environment carrying near production or full production, which is what our product was really designed to do. So we almost wound up like a red team, green team thing. It was like Claude was the red team. Claude was really the green team. And our kind of SRE oriented product was really red team.
Yeah, this is wild. I remember a few jobs ago being that person arguing that, hey, we need to treat our pre-production environments like production. Because if we do not, what chance do we have to prevent defects from going downstream? I mean, and also just the implications, if you have a dev or test mechanism that's broken, it's going to prevent you from being able to ship code anyway. You might as well treat it as a production issue. It's really refreshing to see more and more people coming to that conclusion. And I think with this higher level of velocity that your team is enabling, as well as other companies are starting to encounter it, I think more and more it's going to become more important. And it isn't just what's going on in prod anymore. It's in many ways what you're running into and discovering is like what the folks in the DevOps books were trying to talk about over a decade ago, but maybe they said it too early.
You know, to me, there's a huge, I've always been a believer though, the difference between having a T-shaped person on the team, you know, somebody who's very, very deep in one area, but also so intellectually curious and broad that they really enjoy covering a lot of other areas, that a small number of T-shaped people can dramatically outperform an army of I-shaped people who are very deep in one area and that's it.
Yeah.
But I think going from I-shaped to T-shaped is scary. It takes sometimes a huge learning curve before you're even like a novice level effective. And I think that the big democratization these technologies bring, I mean, I'm just watching like T-shaped behavior pop up all the time, not only on my team, but like we serve some enterprise teams. I had one engineering leader, actually one team that we serve, say, hey, I mentioned the T-shaped, I-shaped thing. And he's like, we used to be an escalate and wait culture like that. I didn't like it, but that was the culture that we had.
Yeah.
And moving from that to a T-shaped culture, it's just a very different engineering culture. And I think that's without AI, that's really scary and really hard. And with AI, suddenly it's just an easier thing to achieve.
Yeah. What a timely remark. I was speaking to a SRE executive for a very large bank yesterday. And they mentioned something very similar, particularly around the idea that, hey, once LLMs deployed in the right way can start handling a lot of the sources of toil for let's say, the SRE persona. SREs start getting really worried. Okay, this mechanism is you know, creating instrumentation for me that I used to do by myself by hand. I'm a little bit worried about the future of my employment. And the point that they made on our conversation was, no, SRE is such a broad discipline. Okay, if we're not thinking about the bottom of Mikey Dickerson's pyramid, former Googler, of course, like yeah. You know, you have the monitoring and the incident response, in the bottom of that diagram, the Google book. Well, guess what? That means you can do capacity planning. That means there's other operational responsibilities. We've been so busy and distracted around incident response for so long that we forgot that there are other things that SREs can do beyond just that. So your remark about becoming T-shaped and being like, yes, I am a specialist in X, but I am also, I also know, you know, end to end how the sausage is made, and I can play a role in each of those operational responsibilities. Even if I'm not, you know, a savant at it, I at least can participate in a meaningful way. I think that is the future for us, you know, operator type folks, but I think it's the same for also software engineering in general.
Yeah.
That SWE is going to be challenged to, hey, do you know the infrastructure that you're running your app on and why it matters? You know, like just starting there, it would be a huge transformation in engineering cultures.
I mean, I think that there's actually a lot of parallels here with AI coding, where, you know, now when you're AI coding at speed, it really does feel like you're sort of herding this fleet of agents that are doing the coding for you.
Yes.
I think that the future of SRE is very much you're herding this fleet. I think SRE is a bit different, not only of agents, there are also humans involved in the SRE world. Like you're herding a fleet of developers and security engineers and other AI, like you're herding this fleet of people towards really, 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 really effective incident response. That's not only in prod, but that's in any environment. I think that the types of folks who do really well here are the folks who come at it with a tool builder mindset.
Yeah.
That every time I see an issue, I'm going to build tools that not only work for me, but I'm going to publish tools so that anybody on any team in any environment who sees something that's even kind of vaguely related to this suddenly is going to, without thinking about it much, pick up my tool and move a lot faster themselves. I think that's a job that is like 10x more valuable. And I think there's like 10x of volume. I don't think that the SRE job is going to disappear whatsoever. I just think it will become much more about tool building and enabling. And then the top of the pyramid will be things like, okay, so let's analyze the human, let's analyze the socio-technical system that we've got.
Yeah.
What tools are missing so that as an entire socio-technical system, we are actually getting better and better and better at reliability over time. That I think that's like the highest form of the art, and that job is going to be more in demand. I wrote this one blog post at the beginning of the year, predictions for 2026, the P75, the top percentile of SRE pay, I believe will actually go up by 30%. I think the job is actually more valuable when done well.
Yeah. You're speaking my language. So what the vision that you're describing is a shift from, let's be honest, a very reactive mode. Like SRE median is I'm doing a lot of incident response. I'm in the process of learning from failure. I'm trying to feed the feedback loop so that way engineering teams maybe perhaps will incorporate what we've learned into production. That's like P50 behavior. But what you're describing is moving away from that entirely to the point where you are just focused on aggressive removal of toil.
Yes.
Like, and you're not even looking at it in terms of what toil is there presently. It's I'm looking into the future and anticipating what toil will be there through technological choices, organizational structures, and so on. Yeah, I very much agree with that sentiment. I feel like professionally, I've been trying to drive towards that, but it's like it required so many organizational dependencies that have been in many ways solved through the force multiplication of AI-driven development. Like it's just easier for me to take an idea and convert it into code now So it's reasonable for us to say, oh, okay, well, let's direct this magic wand and wave it at the toil stuff. Right? Like, why not? If we have this order of magnitude amount of code volume, we can direct even a fraction of it towards the non-functional requirements we've been crying about and make some real impact.
Yeah. I mean, I was thrilled the first time I saw a demo. This is a few months ago now. The first time I saw a demo of somebody with our system, you know, showing me like, hey, the system coming back. Somebody asked a question. The system's coming back saying, hey, sorry, I don't know the answer to that. Oh, that's kind of a bummer. Hey, I found the answers to all of the things I need to know to write the code to fetch the bit of information that I need to answer that question. Here is the code. Can I execute it? And by the way, if you like it, can I now publish it to myself as a skill that any of my background agents can now use in the future forever? Like, oh, now we're talking. All we needed to know is to be able to ask a question and have the system come back and say, I don't know, just once. And we have a problem that we can solve. And there's something beautiful about that. The job then becomes just ask good questions.
Yes. Yes. And there's this interesting positive reinforcing feedback loop. One of my favorite podcasts besides my own, of course, is Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And he recently had a guest that's like the OG AI person. I forget his name. I'll have to put it in the show notes and in the listing to the episode. But he was describing this idea of like, hey, everybody's like ranting and raving about AGI. But, you know, if you're able to just have an AI be able to augment itself with things that it is learning out in the world, like you mentioned, I'm going to write myself a new skill for this problem that I just encountered. You now have this power where using natural language, just like we go out in the world and we're learning new things, right? Like I'm learning right now how to back up my trailer into a driveway and not suck at it. You know, like that is a skill. And once I have it, my capabilities as a human being has vastly improved. We're giving those similar feedback loop to an LLM.
Yep.
And that, if exploited well, you get similar increases in capabilities. And you're not even having to necessarily write a pull request because the artifact is natural language.
Yeah. I think some of it sort of bridges on, you know, like the OpenClaw, you know, Manus, I think, first started this area with like early kind of attempts. But then I think OpenClaw made it really, really popular in both a very positive and funny way. I mean, I spent the weekend reading the book. I hope everybody else did. It was funny. And like a really, really negative way. Like I then spent the next week like reading all the posts about the security fallout.
Oh, yeah, of course.
We've been working on background agents for like 2 years now. Right?
Yeah.
And background agents that touch production systems. And so there's a lot, like how do you build background agents that can do a lot of learning and that can touch background systems in really, really, really safe ways, which means that we had to take a whole bunch of very conservative design decisions with regards to our background agents. One of the big things that I think the industry is going to see next, and we just see it early because we've been working on this thing for so long, when you have a foreground agent that you can interrupt and that you give read-only credentials and that you only expect to run for between 5 and 20 minutes before, you know, while you're kind of watching it go, call it a foreground agent. You give her these really, really broad skills and you give her this really broad problem and it kind of uses its broad skills. Hey, here's a skill, use kubectl. And it'll just like keep on making up kubectl commands to like make some progress and it'll fail and succeed and fail and succeed, et cetera. With background agents, that gets really dangerous really fast because, man, when they go off the rails, they go off the rails. Like fast in really weird and very unpredictable ways. And they work around any guard. They're like my 11-year-old, like no matter what screen time code I put in, he is going to get through it because he really likes Minecraft. Like whatever guardrails I can put in, it doesn't matter. He will figure out a way around them. And I think background agents are kind of the same way. So the solution, you give them these really narrowly defined skills. And you say, okay, the creation of a new skill is a human in the loop. Creation of a new skill to fetch any new data is a human in the loop. The creation of skills to process data that you've already collected. Okay, there are actually cases where you can let it do that. All right, you've collected about 8-10 megabytes worth of really interesting data from production. You want to write a Python script to actually try to figure out how to parse that and re-index it in a way? All right, fine, so be it. But anything that's going to involve any collection of new data, okay, that's a human in the loop new skill. And the skills are really, really, really narrowly defined. Like not like use kubectl, but like get me the deployment events from the cart service in Online Boutique in Sandbox Cluster 1. And when you define the skills really, really, really narrowly, you can control RBAC really easily. You can control agentic background behavior really easily. And you can kind of just keep them on the rails. The downside is it's just a huge amount of work up front. It was a massive, massive, massive amount of work. We had to write like literally thousands of these narrowly scoped background skills and all kinds of tools that generate new background skills. But I do think that in fraud for like big AISRE at, you know, Fortune 100, like really, really heavy scale, I do think the background agents are the way forward. But I think it's these narrow skill, like tens of thousands of narrow skills with background agents that are going to wind up being the way forward instead of broad, hey, do whatever the heck you want with these production credentials types of things.
Yeah. Listeners, rewind like a minute and play that back. because I'm serious. I've been thinking about this as well, because it will not be long before the idea of background agents being normalized in the management of infrastructure. So if that is the case, my mental experiment that I've been thinking about on that road trip was, okay, if that is true, what, it's kind of like Asimov's rules of robotics. You know, you don't let the robot hurt another human being. Those sorts of things. What are Asimov's rules of robotics for these background AI agents that we want to manage production for us? And one of the things that immediately came to mind, and I'm so happy that you said similar, is that you're giving the agent a very strict range of motion. So for example, like I have a tool that manages my website for my business. And it has several commands. It can do a dev environment. Mm-hmm. It can build. It can deploy. And it can clear the CDN's cache. That is all it can do. That is the only thing it does. And that's the only way that I touch that site. Right? And that means that runbook, reasoning, it's all real simple. I mean, also, if you think about a lot of CD pipelines, what are you able to do? I'm able to promote this build artifact. I'm able to monitor the health of this build artifact. I am able to roll back to a previously verified build artifact. That's the range of motion.
Yep.
And that means that the agent that's driving that mechanism is therefore predictable. And you're basically doing like Toyota Kata's, you're implementing safety in the mechanism that is being automated.
Yeah.
Right. You can't turn on the microwave when it's open.
Yeah.
You're doing similar with your agents. No, this is really cool stuff. And I think to me, it sounds very cutting edge, but I think it's important for us to perhaps put together some ground rules and principles that, hey, if you're going to go down this road, here are some guidelines that are going to keep you safe and keep your investors and your customers sleeping at night.
I mean, the upside is, look, I think the massive upside of these background agents, when you get the design right, it's a ton of work to get narrow skills right up and running, because you need lots of them, right? You can't get by with a few. You need like, I think our largest customer has like 40,000 of them running in production, literally 40,000 background skills. Yeah. Like you need huge, 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 huge numbers of background skills. But the upside is, as I mentioned, like four orders of magnitude less data than a typical observability stack, because you use lots and lots of tools, but the data that they collect is actually very, very rich. It's different from collecting like 2 megabytes of logs. You try to read 2 megabytes of logs, like that's pretty boring. I've done it before. It's awful. I don't want to do it again. You know, but, like we can, you know, with these background agents, you can collect better data, I think, than current observability stacks. I think that you can collect it. You can collect better information in far less data, vastly lower cost, and you can re-index and serve it up to humans in ways that are extraordinarily high value. And I don't think I think it's like a mindset to build, but I think once you get in the habit of it, we do this 30 tools in 30 days thing with customers to get people like in the habit. And then once somebody's in the habit of it, man, they just fly through it. It's just like, once you kind of get in the swing of it, it's just not that hard.
Yeah. You definitely mentioned that. Like, I think that's one of the big differentiators is that it's kind of interesting. Cause like in the ancient days, system operators, what they were called, they were writing shell scripts and they had a bunch of Perl and a bunch of SHA. And they were manipulating production. And in many ways, we have returned to that sacred ancient art.
Uh-huh. Yep.
It's just that we're no longer calling them. it's really funny how older principles in operating production systems have made this triumphant return, you know, when an LLM is calling them. I mean, even other operational best practices like documentation, it's been pulling teeth for the past decade to get people to doc their stuff. But magically, it's like, oh, well, because this thing is going to code for me, I better document to the T what the system is supposed to do. You know? Okay, so one final topic for us to explore with our remaining time. So we've explored a little bit about the implications on how operating systems will change in this new world. You're taking part in ushering in. Are there any other aspects of production systems operations that you think will radically change? And if so, how? For example, we were talking about code review. Hey, we can't review such a large body of code. What other changes you think will be ushered in?
I mean, I think SLIs and SLOs will see a comeback. And it's funny I say comeback because they got very, very popular in literature, and a lot of people were talking about them, but it takes a service. Like, you've gone into a bunch of clients and said, like, hey, here's SLIs that you need. Let me think through SLOs. I think it's hard today to without an expert helping you through it, and an expert who really knows your business. You know, like, I'm guessing for your client, you have to spend a lot of time getting to know their business. Mm-hmm. I think, like, for me as like an executive at the moment running a software company, like, I really, 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 really want to see our SLOs, because I, even though I consider myself to be somebody who's very, very close, I mean, I wrote over 500,000 lines of code for our product myself, but that's not my job anymore. And now that I'm a little far from it and the team is writing so much so fast, I need a few invariants to know that we didn't do any damage to customers. Otherwise, I just can't sleep at night.
Yeah.
And that's like really, really, really important. And I think that applies not to me because my role is a CEO. I think that applies to everybody who works for our organization, because all of us care really deeply about the customer experience. Like, that is the most important thing for no matter what your freaking job title is here. Like, the customer experience is the important thing.
Yeah.
And I think for all of us, we all get scared when there's just this much code moving around. But I think that SLIs and SLOs are the right mechanism to be able to say, hey, yes, we're all scared. We know that this handful of SLIs, yes, they're averages of many, many others, but we know that when we look at this small set, our customers are okay. And that's what I want to know, so that we can be releasing daily and we can be releasing, you know, 285 file, 200,000 line PRs. Like, I want to know that my customers are okay, because that's what we all care about most. I think the time is ripe for like a big resurgence of SLIs, SLOs. I think building them off synthetic tests is kind of the way to make them most intuitive for most people, rather than like a paragraphs long metrics query. Mm-hmm. They're like, hey, let's just run this script like every minute and see if it comes back one or zero. And like, we can all like agree and like vibe code and add little stuff to the script as much as we want. Like, that part is so easy to express now that there's no reason why not.
Yeah.
And it just makes it incredibly intuitive that we can say, all right, the script runs every minute. Every time it hits a one, my customers are okay. But I just think the demand for that is just sitting there and is sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. And we just have to make it friction free.
Yeah. Listeners, I promise you, I did not tell Kyle to say that. He said that himself. I mean, I'm a big SLO proponent, you know, as part of my consultancy. It's one of the major things that I'm assessing and pushing and proselytizing is, hey, do you know whether or not your customer is happy using your product? Because if they're not, they're going to find a competitor and they're going to leave at renewal time. Protect your revenue, right? And yeah, I think you're correct. In a world where the rate of change to production systems is so giant, you do need some objective measure of whether or not the thing you're building is improving or degrading the quality of your customer experience. There is no better tool for that than the service level objective. On that, we obviously agree. So with that, I feel very, very hopeful that more and more companies that are really, you know, wanting to adopt this new model start to adopt that as a piece of it. I think you can't really do agentic development at this velocity without SLOs in place. I think it's impossible.
It keeps it safe. It just keeps it safe.
It just keeps it safe. All right. Well, this was a barn burner of a podcast episode. I love discussing this with you because we're discussing not you know, like best practices. We're speculating what's out in the future in terms of them based on stuff that just hit the page. The ink hasn't even dried yet. So yeah, I think we're discussing the good parts of the AI world, and how it can really make our lives better as software developers and engineers and SREs and whatnot. So for folks that would love to hear more from you, maybe ask some questions, maybe explore Runwen, where can they reach you?
I'm all LinkedIn. Like I don't do any other kind of social stuff. I think on LinkedIn, I still even have like a just straight book a meeting link that just goes directly to my Calendly. Yeah, we're still in like that stage. So I'd love to hear from anybody on this topic. Agree, disagree, like that's okay. I think that we're all going through this as an industry together, and trading notes with people who are really, really, really advanced in this journey, and trading notes with people who feel like they're really far behind in this journey and want to make a leapfrog moment. I'm really interested. I'm really interested in also people who want to make this a big part of their next career move. I think that there's just this moment, and it's this unique moment, and we're so lucky to be professionals at this moment, that somebody who wants to use this to take the next step in their career, whichever direction that they want to go in with that. If there's anything that I can do to help, I mean, I just love helping people get to where they want to go career-wise. It's what I like to do most.
Awesome. I'm sure folks will definitely appreciate that outreach. All right, Kyle, an absolute pleasure. Really enjoyed this conversation.
I mean, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it. I appreciate it a ton.
Thank you for listening to today's edition of Reliability Rebels. Until next time.
Check one, check two.
Reliability
Rebels. Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check,